From the Sky News Centre at 5, the Home Office says the resignation of one of its drug advisers in a row over policy is regrettable. Eric Carling claims the decision to criminalise methadone was rushed through. It was announced earlier this week that the legal high will be banned and made a Class B drug after it was linked to several deaths. Mr Carling thinks it was politically motivated.
We've taken it as a specifically as a criminal justice issue because that's what the Home Secretary's interested in, that's what the politicians and media are interested in. We could be tough on drugs before an election. It's intellectually wrong and it's morally corrupt.
The Foreign Office has called for restraint after a series of Israeli airstrikes on Gaza. Three Palestinian children are thought to have been wounded in the attacks, which followed the recent killing of two Israeli soldiers. Yaakov Katz is a journalist at the Jerusalem Post. He says there had been relative peace following Israel's offensive on Gaza in January 2009.
Israel would like the lull to return. Israel would prefer to have the border quiet as it's been over the past year. But when it finds itself under attack, I think that it feels that it has no choice but to respond militarily.
Wildcat industrial action by French ferry workers is affecting Easter holiday travel. Sea France crossings from Dover today have been cancelled, and there's no word on when the strike action's due to finish. Other operators are running services as normal. It's emerged a woman killed when a tyre exploded inside her sports car had returned from a tour of Afghanistan 2 weeks ago. Captain Jenna Wilcox, a US Air Force officer who was based at RAF Mildenhall in Suffolk, was on a break in Scotland with her husband. While in the war zone, she kept a blog and described conversations with him as being very loving because death is imminent. In sport, Birmingham midfielder Craig Gardner's hit back at Arsene Wenger's suggestion that it was his initial tackle which led to Cesc Fabregas breaking his leg. William Gallas is likely to miss the rest of the season too. He has a calf injury. That's the latest. I'm Sasha Twining.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
BCFM is a community radio station for Bristol. So, what exactly does that mean?
Well, it means that anybody can get involved in any way you want.
Yeah, but what if you haven't done radio before?
That doesn't matter, because BCFM have qualified tutors that run training courses that tell you everything you need to know.
To find out more information, go to www.bcfm.org.uk.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello and welcome to a special Good Friday edition of BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and this Easter weekend we've resisted the temptation to drag a poor MP or city councillor into the studio. Instead, I'll be taking a step back and look at the Good Friday Northern Ireland Peace Agreement, which was signed in 1998, 12 years ago today. Joining me is Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and BCFM Bristol Arts Show presenter Billy Quayne. After the 6 o'clock news, Easter, what's it all about? And Easter bunnies, what have they got to do with the Jewish Passover and the crucifixion of Jesus nearly 2,000 years ago today? We look at how the date is determined and some of the different religious traditions that brought us here. And one of the best dramas ever produced in Bristol, Private Eye, Eddie Shoestring, played by Trevor Eve in 1979 and 1980. Why has it still not had an official release on DVD? And where can you get it from? Have your pen and paper ready if you're interested in Shoestring in the second hour. On to this week's news in a minute, but first here's our two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. The temperatures this weekend averaging 6 degrees Celsius and fairly wet on Saturday with a few sunny spells. Dry on Sunday, though, with more sunny spells. Next week, we're averaging 10 degrees Celsius in the daytime. Cloudy at the beginning of the week with some rain. Dry with plenty of sunny spells towards the end of the week. And I don't know if you noticed, but we did forecast a little bit of sleet in the middle of last week, which actually did happen the right day. Next weekend is the 10th and 11th of April, and then it'll be averaging around 9 degrees Celsius. Cloudy with some rain on Saturday and dry with sunny spells on Sunday. A little bit similar to this weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. Now, I'm joined in the studio by Billy Quayne and Martin Summers. Welcome, folks.
Hi. Thank you for having us along.
And we're going to start really looking at some of the chronology that led up to the Good Friday Agreement and to the Irish Troubles. First of all, the Good Friday Agreement was signed on Good Friday, April the 10th, 1998, and it ended 30 years of the Troubles. It signalled the end of a conflict which began its latest phase in 1968. The significance of the signing on Good Friday was one of Catholic and Protestant reconciliation. But let's start by just talking about some definitions, because a lot of terms which are used in discussing Northern Ireland politics and religion are really quite complicated, aren't they? Billy, can you just talk about the Catholics and Nationalists? What's, you know, why do these various terms and Republicans get used, and what's the difference?
It's a difficult one, and it does go back, as you said, hundreds of years. Bearing in mind, Protestantism as the official religion of Britain occurred sometime in the middle of the 16th century. I think it was around 1525 or 1528 or whenever it was that Pope Gregory the whatever he was decided that Henry the Eighth was no longer Defensor Fidelis after he appointed himself head of the British Church, modelled very much on the German model, but in total contrast with his earlier publication in cahoots with Thomas More, who was a great fan of Erasmus. Anyway, I'm not going to go down that route.
Thank goodness for that.
Essentially, Ireland in the 12th century, in 1169, invited Strongbow to come and settle a dispute between some of the Irish lords, which was a foolish thing to do. At the time, of course, all of these people were Catholic. So the Normans, as they were, came in, and they were kind of welcome conquerors, as it were. They intermarried with the Irish chieftains, they settled down, they built tower house castles, very few examples of which remain. Then it all kind of started getting a bit complicated under the reign of Henry VIII. If you cast your minds back to the Field of Cloth of Gold, there was ongoing wars with France, and the one thing that Henry wanted more than anything else was a better navy than France. Ireland at the time was almost entirely covered with oak forest. So this was the place for him to go and get the natural resources to build his magnificent armada that he needed to keep the French at bay. To do that, it was incumbent on him, certainly after he had converted to Protestantism, to get the Irish nobility to convert to his new faith. He wasn't militant about it, but he also required the wealth of the Irish monasteries, which for probably 900 years prior to Henry taking the throne had been the envy of Europe. It's important to remember that as Christianity, after the fall of the Roman Empire, Christianity got pushed further and further west. All that was left of the old Roman Empire was the judiciary and a number of monasteries. Ireland re-exported their version of Christianity and the wealth of their libraries, first of all into Scotland and then proliferated down through Northern England. This is going way back into ancient history. To answer the question that you've asked me,
One of the things I'm fascinated by is this: is the motivation of the... Well, it's easy to pigeonhole people as either Catholics or Nationalists, but do you think their motivation is primarily a Catholic religious one, or is it a nationalistic one? Because they're actually two different things, really, aren't they?
I would say it's more to do with nationalism, because the Irish as a breed, as any island nation will tell you, they're an immensely proud people. And it is about love of the land, love of the country. Russians are very much the same. Germans, for some strange reason, have a tremendous feeling of kinship with their motherland, or das Vaterland, as they see it. The French not so much, and it's a strange one that English people are made to feel embarrassed of being patriotic a lot of the time. Certainly since the football hooliganism of the 1970s, I think it's not a fun, fashionable, okay PC thing to be patriotically English. The Scots are okay with it and the Welsh are okay with it.
Well, that's been kind of territorially squatted by the British National Party, hasn't it?
They've moved into the vacuum that's there now, and it's a very strange one. And actually, on the converse side of that, part of this lack of identity I encounter with a lot of English people is the fact that the Church of England, by its very nature, doesn't require weekly attendance, and it doesn't require that you do things and you're defined by things, and communities brought together on a very, very regular basis. However, I digress yet again. The Catholic-Protestant issue arose after Henry VIII sacked the monasteries because he needed the money. After that, his daughter Elizabeth I went in, and she really did start quite maliciously planting the country. Any of the Irish nobles who weren't complying with her new directives or weren't converting to Protestantism were basically forced into subjugation, and their lands were just given to mercenaries.
So this is what's known as the plantations, isn't it? And
yes.
This is the 16th and 17th century, and uh-huh. It was described as the settlement of Ireland by English and Scottish families, which was encouraged by an English government as a means of anglicising the country and securing Ireland's allegiance. So is that fair?
It's absolutely fair. I mean, they just decided to, well, if we can't rule you from London, we'll plant our own people in there who will agree with us.
Yeah, what's quite interesting about this, in 1798, there was an uprising against British rule in Ireland, and the leaders of that uprising, Wolfe Tone and others, were actually Belfast Protestants.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And so the Republican tradition originally originated in the northern Protestant community.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the uprising itself eventually degenerated into a kind of race war, as it were, between the Catholics and the Protestants, which was not actually the original intention of the rebels. And the Orange Order came out of that. The Orange Order became out of that failed uprising, and they were very much pro the British occupation, and as it were, the Protestant community in the north kind of changed sides. Yeah, but that is one of the threads in the Republican tradition which shouldn't be forgotten. Of course, that's why the Irish flag has a green bit and an orange bit on it, mm-hmm. because it represents the unity of the two communities.
So, the Orange Order you mentioned there, it's an Irish sectarian society named after William of Orange. William of Orange was King of England from 1688 to 1702. Seven London MPs brought William over from Holland to depose King James II. Every man who is initiated into the Orange Order is pledged to maintain the Protestant succession and keep Catholics out of power. It was formed in 1795 as a counter-organisation to the Catholic land rights movements, and in the 1880s the Irish Home Rule movement emerged, and the Orange Order vehemently opposed it. After 1920, the Orange Order continued as a backup to the Ulster Unionist Party. All senior Unionist politicians are expected to become members, and so it's a bastion of Protestant Unionism in the north of Ireland. Do you think that's a fair description, both of you?
King Billy, of course, there's a statue of King Billy in Queen's Square in Bristol. Apparently,
so does that mean there's a similar tradition in Bristol?
Well, I'm just saying there's a statue of him. If you want to see what he looks like, go down to Queen's Square and have a look.
That was a pretty succinct, overarching set of 600 years of Irish history. But yes, you kind of got it in a nutshell. Basically, the Protestants, as the indigenous Irish felt, were thieves. They just stole the land from the Irish Catholics, charged them exorbitant rents, did nothing to make their lives any easier, and they weren't good landlords, which meant that the tenants weren't good tenants.
But I mean, I know one of the historical things in England is enclosure, and quite a lot of these settlers may possibly have been people who were cleared or evicted from their properties in England. So in a way, I don't know about the whereabouts they came from, whether they were all voluntarily going to another land.
A lot of them were Cromwell's demobbed soldiers. Now, there were two main waves of plantation, one in Elizabeth the First time, as Billy said earlier, and the second main wave was after the War of the Three Kingdoms, or the English Civil War. And as I said, the Protestant community had, in fact, by the 1790s, become Irishized. You know, mm-hmm. they actually identified with Ireland as a country.
Yes.
And then the Orange Order, because of the failure of that uprising, the Orange Order then started to lead the community in an opposite direction, and they've been leading them in that opposite direction ever since.
Yes.
Although as we know, the Good Friday Agreement has brought some light at the end of that tunnel.
Well, going along in history a little bit, one of the next big events was the Irish potato famine from 1847 to 1851. Potato blight and inadequate relief by the Westminster government. 1 million people starved to death in Ireland, and another million emigrated. What's your understanding of the famine? I mean, to what extent, Billy, do you think it could have been averted?
It could very easily have been averted. As I said, it had been at that stage probably a century and a half of underinvestment in absentee landlords' holdings in Ireland. The nature of hygiene, sanitation, health issues at the time meant you would sire as many children as you could so that you'd be looked after in your dotage, because infant mortality was high, juvenile mortality was high, and adult mortality was high. If you, for instance, managed to sire 14 children, then you would have maybe two or three that would outlive you, and hopefully they would be the ones who would then take care of you. The consequence of that was that the tenants, because they weren't allowed to own any of this land, and there was a succession of land acts passed in the 1720s, which ensured that you had to be Protestant if you were going to have a significant land holding in Ireland, which wasn't repealed, interestingly, until 1910 with the Windham and Balfour Land Act. The little plots of land that were allocated to families, the more children you had, the smaller that plot got. So where I'm from, in West Cork, for instance, you do see, even now, very beautifully marked out tiny fields, which whole families were expected to subsist on, and very poor quality land, because, you know, as I said, the capital investment wasn't coming in from the landlords.
Isn't that one of the reasons that Ulster is Northern Ireland and is Protestant, is because some of that was the best land in the entire country?
That's part of it, certainly. But I think the reason, there's an important difference to strike between Ulster and Northern Ireland. Ulster is a province of Ireland consistent of nine counties.
Oh yes, it's a slight difference, isn't it?
Yeah. Northern Ireland are the six most Protestant counties under Carson in the 1920s, during the Border Commission, which was set up after the Irish Civil War. We're skipping through a lot of stuff.
No, I think the Border Commission is something that we need to pick up on, because in the treaty in 1920, as agreed by Collins, there was supposed to be a border drawn which was based upon population, analysis of the population, and that analysis of the population was done in Poland when Poland split from Germany at that stage, and there was a line drawn based on population, and that's what Collins had agreed to. And of course the Border Commission did look into redrawing the border, and if they'd drawn the border properly, South Armagh, for example, would have been in the Republic. So would other bits of the north, but the British basically reneged on the agreement, and that's why you had a big nationalist Catholic population inside the six counties, because it wasn't actually drawn rationally. And that, and in a way, that's quite interesting, because that means that there will have to be a united Ireland one day. If that border had been drawn properly in 1920, you could have said, right, we have separated it out here.
Yes, absolutely.
But now, because they insisted on having the biggest area of land they could have, mm-hmm. that the troubles were almost inevitable as a result of that.
We'll come back to that.
But at the same time, ultimately, some kind of accommodation will have to come as a result of this.
I totally agree with you, and it's certainly worth revisiting. For now, we're going to listen to the Stiff Little Fingers and their track Fly the Flag.
Stiff Little Fingers there, and a song called Fly the Flag. Welcome back to our Good Friday special on the Good Friday Agreement. And we're in the middle of discussing Northern Irish and Southern Irish, Irish generally, history at the moment. And we're going back now to the Easter Rising of 1916. I'm joined by Martin Summers and our arts show presenter, Billy Quain. Billy, why did the Easter Rising happen when it did? It's the 24th to the 29th of April, 1916. So this is another event, isn't it, that's happened at Easter, which is of crucial significance in Ireland.
Absolutely. I'm not going to allow myself to get distracted. To cut a long story short, there had been a number of land reforms put through the Westminster government regarding ownership and Catholic rights in Ireland.
That's right, because Irish MPs held the balance of power, didn't they, in Westminster? So they were able to actually get some really important legislation through affecting Ireland.
Mm-hmm. And this had all been running up. And then, as luck would have it, before we got to the final step of a peaceful solution, World War I broke out. At the time, Ireland was still a British colony, as I see it, or British people will tell you it was part of Great Britain. Hordes of Irishmen signed up to take the Queen's shilling, as it were, and go off as rank and file to the trenches. Fought as British patriots in the Great War. Problem being, of course, they were literally being used as cannon fodder, as a lot of the regiments who were coming from the colonies were during the First World War. They literally, who are we going to send in for this? You either send in the Indians or you send in the Irish or the Africans. And that was the nature of the beast at the time. The loss of life was appalling. The compensation wasn't the same as any of the British regiments, as they were seen. The mainland regiments were better compensated for loss of life. I'm sure somebody from the MOD will phone up and say that actually never happened, but I think you'll find it did. And it came to a head. We weren't getting anywhere peacefully. There was a lot of guns in and out of the place at the time, and it was decided that affirmative action needed to be taken. 16 generals took a number of significant buildings around Dublin, mainly under their control, and the Declaration of Independence, signed by all 16 of them, I think drafted by Padraig Pearse, was declared on the steps of the General Post Office in Dublin.
But you would see why the English government would see this as treachery, as this is happening during the First World War.
Well, I mean, that's true, but you've got to remember that it was the loyalists that had introduced the gun into Irish politics. There was going to be a Home Rule Bill, which was going to be a peaceful Home Rule for Ireland, and the loyalists said Ulster will fight and Ulster will be right. The Conservative Party backed them up in this, and they were the ones who got loads of German rifles to arm the Ulster Volunteer Force. And it was only when they'd armed themselves up that the Republican movement decided they would have to get some weaponry. So, I mean, the seeds of the current conflict were sown in 1916, basically, because it's, what's happened since 1969 is effectively unfinished business from that era.
Now, something was set up at that time called the Irish Free State. That's the Government of Ireland Act 1920. So what was the Irish Free State? I mean, when I lived over there back in the 1990s, I can remember people still referring to it. This is in the north, referring to it as the state. We're going to the south of Ireland as the state. We're going to the state this afternoon or whatever.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, we're going quickly through broad strokes here. The 16 signatories of the Declaration of Independence on the steps of the GPO were killed, some would say martyred, by the British forces after a British gunship had gone up the River Liffey and bombed them out of the forecourts and bombed them out of.
That's right, because there were about 2,000 people involved in the rising,
yes.
But there were only the very top people who the English decided to make an example.
Absolutely, excepting De Valera, who was the only remaining general. Apparently he was on an American passport, so they thought, in light of the fact that America was just about to enter the theatre of war in Europe, to haul everybody's bottoms back out of the trenches and win it for them, it might be best not to upset them by assassinating one of their citizens for his part in an Irish freedom struggle. The martyrdom of them precipitated after the First World War, in the baton being taken up again, and one of the ugliest passages in Irish history, after the demob of a lot of British troops after the First World War, a new brigade called the Black and Tans because of their uniforms were set up, and they were sent in to subjugate the Irish population who had been active militarily since the 1916 Rising. And that led to the War of Independence between 1919 and 1920, which subsequently went on after we finally drove, they say drove the British out. It was sufficiently successful from a military standpoint that Britain was prepared to sign a treaty with De Valera and Michael Collins.
Yeah, I mean, they missed Collins as well. I mean, they missed De Valera, but they also missed Collins because he was a mid-level person and they didn't realise how important he was going to be. Mm. As we said earlier, there was an agreement in that treaty to draw a rational boundary between Protestant Ulster and the rest of Ireland, and I mean, I think that was foolish of the Republicans to agree to that, but they did agree that there was going to be a partition. And of course, sadly enough, the Civil War in Ireland wasn't about partition; it was about a form of words in the treaty, mm-hmm. Which is talk about fighting over the irrelevancies when there's actually a substantial issue here.
Yes, absolutely.
But nevertheless, as I said earlier, if the Border Commission had been allowed to operate, then there probably would have been two separate states. Somebody would always be on the wrong side of the line. I used to be an aid worker in Bosnia, and wherever you draw a line, somebody's going to be on the wrong side of it. But at least it would have been rational. But the British actually reneged on their part of the treaty. They didn't allow the Boundary Commission to operate, and so you got this basically sectarian state with a large minority of Catholics and Nationalists in it, which of course was a little ticking time bomb waiting to go off. And of course in 1969 it did go off.
Well, there was an uneasy peace until Northern Ireland Civil Rights Movement March in Derry on the 5th of October 1968. We'll be talking about that in a minute, but first we're going to hear from Christy Moore with a song called Joe McCann.
Fine people, wherever you may be, I'll sing of a brave Belfast man who scorned the army's might, thought they'd shoot him in sight, and they shot down Joe McCann, Joe McCann. They shot down Joe McCann Belfast Bakery in the August of that year, when internment was imposed throughout the land. Six volunteers from Belfast held 600 troops at bay. Their leader was Joe McCann, Joe McCann. Their leader was Joe McCann. He fought for the people in the markets where he worked, in defence of the rights of man. But the hired branch crew told the soldiers what to do, and they shot down Joe McCann, Joe McCann. They shot him down. He hit hard to rubble many times. Once for that, he had buttons with him on.
Sorry about that. That's a little bit of a mistake in the Christy Moore's song, Joe McCann. But anyway, welcome back to Friday Drive Time special on the Good Friday Agreement. Two-hour special with Billy Quain, Tony Gosling and Martin Summers. Now, Martin, you wanted to say something about...
Yeah, I'm afraid the CD is quite an old one. It's one of mine. It's skipping there. That was a song about Joe McCann, who was actually a real IRA, official IRA activist. And of course, he went after the civil rights marches. There was actually attempts to drive Catholics out of their areas. So there were big mobs of loyalists, armed loyalists, led by the police, attacking Catholic areas. And that's how the IRA, the modern IRA, got started, because a few people stood up to them and shot. You know, but Joe McCann held them all off with a rifle that he happened to have, because he was, you know, the IRA was still operating.
Well, the so-called official beginning of the Troubles is on the 5th of October 1968, a very big march in Londonderry, by the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Movement. Billy, what was the Civil Rights Movement? movement and why did it happen?
Well, the civil rights movement were, amongst others, Bernadette Devlin and some of her followers, and they were just a group of Catholics who were sick to the back teeth. They weren't exclusively Catholics, bearing in mind. There was a lot of Protestant academics in particular at the time were very much in favour of their cause. It was about the disparity of job opportunities, about the disparity of entitlements, and about just general... If we look, for instance, at the divide, say, between the southern black community in the United States and the more affluent northern white communities, it was very much along those lines. If you were Catholic and you were Northern Irish, you were destined for a more impoverished life than you ever would be.
Well, the Protestants were the landowners and the business owners, weren't they?
Well, Harland and Wolff, right until possibly even now, had a policy of not employing Catholics. Bearing in mind, that was the biggest employer in Belfast for decades. So, you know,
there was also an issue, I seem to remember, over voting rights as well, because there were quite a lot of disenfranchised Catholics as well.
You had to be, to vote in local elections in Northern Ireland, you had to be a property owner. Yeah, so you've got to actually own a piece of property, or you've got to have a flat. Yes, you did. That's why when the allocation of flats led to allocation of votes. So if you don't put a Catholic in that flat, they don't get a vote.
Well, there were a lot of housing estates, or there were several places where Catholics were living where they simply hadn't got their vote. That was another one of the reasons for the civil rights march.
Well, they also drew the constituencies to make sure they could never get anybody elected and stuff like this, which is why, of course, one of the backgrounds to the agreement is to have a fair voting system.
So this is gerrymandering, really.
Pretty much. And of course, this goes back again, unfortunately, the problem with Irish politics, it always looks backwards. It goes back to the Boundary Commission, and the Boundary Commission was constructed specifically around a Protestant majority. That's the lines are where they were put because it encircled a Protestant majority. The downside, or maybe the upside, as the generations progressed, and I know this is going to sound like an awful stereotype, because Catholics, by their very nature, appear to be a more progenitive sect of people, the dynamic...
They have more children.
Yes. Yeah. The voting dynamic will naturally shift because... As more children come
on,
voting.
On that point, I saw Gary McMichael speak at a conference in the TUC in London a few years ago. And
who's he, Martin?
Gary McMichael was the then head of the UDA, which is the Ulster Defence Association, which is a loyalist paramilitary extremist group, really. And he was debating with a lot of nationalists and Republicans. And this one nationalist stood up and said, look, eventually, making the point Billy's just made, there is going to be a nationalist Catholic majority in the six counties. It may come in 12 years' time, in 20 years' time, in 50 years' time, but you know that's going to come. And he stood up and said, yes, we do know that's going to come. We know exactly that will happen. And we don't know when, but it will happen in the end, and we're aware of that. And when that day comes, we will expect exactly the same decent treatment from your lot as we're offering you here today. And he got a standing ovation from the Republicans in the room, because that was the right attitude. When the day comes that we're in the majority and you're in the minority, let's make sure that we get a fair treatment. And he said that's why the UDA supports this peace agreement.
Well, might I just suggest that's a preemptive strike after 400 years of mistreatment of a subjugated population.
Indeed. And they didn't come round to that point of view easily.
Okay, so we were talking there about the civil rights movement and civil rights march in Derry in the northwest of Ireland, 5th of October 1968. But the conditions deteriorated until in August 1969, the British Army was called in under Harold Wilson's Labour government, and the Parachute Regiment soldier Richard Cowley we'll be hearing from in a minute. But what do you think, both of you, was the significance of actually making the decision to bring the army in to say basically the Northern Ireland Police can't deal with this situation?
Again, I'll go back to the disparity of public service jobs. The Northern Ireland, the RUC as they were at the time, were predominantly, I would say almost exclusively, a Protestant armed police force. In any situation like that.
Well, they've been leading mobs of armed loyalists to attack the Catholic community with their uniforms on.
You know,
and at a certain point, people are going to fight back to that. And when the army came in, they were welcomed by the nationalists and the Catholics because they thought, well, they're going to hold the line here and we're going to get some fair treatment. But of course, it all started slipping even from that point.
Exactly.
Partly because of the attitudes at the top of the British Army, because they just arrived with their public school nonsense, you know, and the paddies were going to lie down as far as they were concerned.
They had a very, very antiquated view of who the Irish Catholic population were. I still believe that they felt they were, you know, fuzzy-wuzzies, for want of a better expression.
Yeah, well, they'd just come back from Aden, the paras, and they actually lifted, on Bloody Sunday, they actually put up a thing in Arabic saying, disperse or we will shoot, in Arabic. Mm. And they'd just been doing that in Aden.
Worked out well for them, didn't it?
Anyway, we're going to hear now from Richard Cowley, who's a regular contributor to this programme over the last couple of months. And Richard is now going to sort of introduce himself and explain why he decided to join the army.
My name's Bryn Richard Cowley, and I was a private soldier in Northern Ireland from 1980 for about 4 months. I grew up in the bush in Africa and South Africa, East Africa, and I enjoyed the outdoor experience. I wanted to do some free-fall parachuting, and I was always drawn to guns and things like that, so I naturally just chose to the parachute regiment. I joined in 1980. We finished our training in about 6 months, and then we posted that year, 1980, Christmas time, and we spent about 4 months. Then into 1981, we left about April 81. In Ireland, we were based in a place called Auchnacloy, which is on the top of the Monaghan Salient, County Tyrone, where that's the district physically.
Now, as a soldier, you're posted to all sorts of different places. Can you tell us what your first impressions of were arriving in Ireland?
Yeah, because we were straight out of training, you have to realise we're about 20, 21 years old. The average age group was about 20. And we were very excited to arrive there, and we were kitted out immediately with the first taste of handling real weapons with live rounds, you know. Everything was very exciting. We got on the back of a truck. It was a furniture van. There was about 30 of us squeezed in there, so it was not very pleasant, but nevertheless, we were being routed from arrival to the barracks. We all arrived together, and then I think we were sent to about three different barracks around Northern Ireland. I ended up in Auchnacloy. We were basically private soldiers in the paras. We didn't get tasked in anything specifically dangerous or responsible particularly, although sometimes we were kind of deployed into basic ambush positions. But those positions were essentially routinely occupied by any troop, any army that was based in Northern Ireland. So there's nothing specific, just routine patrols, basically, you know, stagging on various times, hedgerows, living rough, getting wet, very bored, miserable, most of the time. Nothing exciting ever happened other than basic roadblocks, stopping people in their cars for no specific reason, checking for arms if they might be carrying anything, you know, just routine checks, essentially. The accommodation was terrible because everybody was very cramped and living on top of each other in bunk beds. There was about at least eight people to this really small room, about 12 by 12. And essentially, when we weren't on top of each other, arguing amongst each other, having fights and stuff like that, we were down in the naffy, and we had this thing called a chogi. And that's, I think that's an Indian word for basically the guy that makes us the best hamburgers. So we said basically, you know, egg burgers or various things like that. So we did about 10 of those a day, loads of cups of coffee, and about 40 cigarettes. And that was basically the routine in the barracks. Horrible.
That was Richard Cowley, ex-member of the Parachute Regiment. Martin and Billy, how do you think it was that even though when the army first arrived they were welcomed by both sides, that it became a situation where really there was much more antagonism from the Catholic side, and the army was seen to be really on the side more of the Protestants?
Well, I think to begin with, from the Protestant standpoint, they, in my view, viewed the army's arrival as reinforcements. I think from the Catholic standpoint, as Martin alluded to before that piece, they were seen as in a more mediatory role, that finally there would be an armed garrison, an armed buffer between the RUC and the Catholic population, and they were essentially there to keep the peace, as the Irish Catholic population saw them. problem was, of course, in any area of dispute or any time that there's a taxation disparity, and I think it's important to mention this, a lot of people around the borderlands were making a lot of money shipping red diesel over in one direction and cigarettes back in the other direction. So the way it's always important to remember there is a huge element of criminality at any time when you're talking about Northern Ireland. The army set up their checkpoints all along the border on the main roads in and out, and eventually they just worked themselves into a position, first of all, of not fully understanding the arena that they were walking into. Not as your other contributor on the audio just then said, they were a lot of bored 21-year-old men with live ammunition at their disposal, and accidents will always happen. I think they probably didn't do themselves any favours when they were in civvies out and about around the towns, and it just kind of backfired, all culminating in Martin.
In Bloody Sunday. But also, of course, what had happened by that stage is that the Labour government had fallen, and you had a Conservative government in Britain, which took a much more pro-unionist line, and there was no real reform going on of the Northern Ireland state. What the Republicans and the Nationalists had expected is, we got the army in here, and now we're going to have a reform. But then that just died, especially with a Conservative government. And the attitude was, basically, croppies lie down. You know, you've had your fun, now you're going to go back in your cage. And of course, at that stage, people got more militant. And there was the internment was brought in, internment without trial, and that, of course, antagonised the community completely. Mm-hmm. There was then a protest against that, and on that protest, the Parachute Regiment opened fire on the demonstrators and killed a number of those demonstrators. Of course, once that had happened, the balloon was up.
Okay, we'll be talking about Bloody Sunday in a moment, but just before we do that, let's have another listen to Richard talking about what it was like to be out on patrol.
So how many of you were there on the patrol, and how did you move down the street?
Well, we essentially moved in a patrol of about a section, which is generally about 8 people, and we were taught how to do street patrols, walking on each side of the pavement, watching each other's back, on each other's flanks, and keeping a consistent eye out for lightly sniper positions, like roof tiles removed from roofs, for example, or through gaps where people could disappear quickly in cul-de-sacs and stuff like that. You know, it was all psychological. There were times when we would go static, and those were the worst times, and you'd find yourself looking around like you'd have 360 peripheral vision of a sixth sense, and you'd find that you were always expecting to see something happening every minute of the day, because you didn't know Belfast very well. It was a very interesting experience for, say, 20 to 21-year-old person with a live round up the spout, you know, expecting to use it at any time. We didn't spend a long time doing that. We were only in Belfast for the day. When we were deployed, we went to a barracks in Auchnacloy, which is actually on the border, on the Mon Mainn salient. So that was the last time we saw of a city. Then after that, we were deployed to basic ambush positions, and concurrent with patrolling the borders at night and during the day. And essentially, the worst thing I remember was the weather being very bad. But
what would be a typical border patrol like?
Okay, that would be our section, which would be about 8 people. The most exciting thing that I do remember for the 4 months there was that we were always deployed to the location by helicopter. So we had a hell of a lot of flight time in various choppers, ranging from Pumas to a Sea King that they use there, and sometimes a lighter Lynx, and that was really good. And you know, I was sort of surprised as well, I must say, to find that sometimes the pilots, the actual sergeant, flight sergeant that were flying the chopper, had actually been in the Paris previously. Yeah, so we were deployed basically by chopper into the green area, and very low-level flights. I remember that as well, looking out the door, often thinking that, I was thinking, you know, this guy's going to hit these low-level wires that we fly over, you know, from and then skipping from around from forest to forest, very low-level. It was quite unnerving, actually, especially at night, you know. So that was quite good. Then we basically get out the chopper and go and, you know, get into an all-round defence, and then move off in tactical formation to set up either an ambush or instigate a patrol. And during that time, we'd be out there for 2 or 3 days living on rat packs or ration packs, you know. And that was always an exciting time, too, in the barracks, where we used to swap and exchange food. And some people didn't like bacon grill, others preferred steak and onion and stuff like that.
Well, that sounds a little bit worrying to me, actually. What the soldiers are really looking forward to and finding exciting is getting their ration packs and swapping different types of food, because, I think the impression we get from Richard really is that most of it was really very, very dull for the soldiers.
Yes, until it got exciting.
Well, okay, so let's talk about Bloody Sunday now. 30th of January, 1972. Billy, what happened?
Well, I have to say, this has been fleshed out very, very well on television with James Nesbitt starring, and also it's been revisited in a number of books and plays, incidentally. My understanding of it, because, history books will take you up to about 15 years before you're born, won't they? Because what's happened in the last 15 years isn't really history. And since I was born in the 70s, my grasp on it is neither first-hand nor historical. Essentially, there was a civil rights march through the city of Derry. There were some elements of disgruntled youth who had decided it was a grand day out and it's an opportunity to chuck stones at Army Land Rovers, which... It can be. I mean, you look at what happened in Bradford not that long ago, or you look at any instance of football hooliganism, or even when Cardiff City take on Bristol City at either one of their venues. It was that sort of tomfoolery. I don't think it was a massively political or, overtly sectarian statement of intent, or it certainly didn't warrant the response that it garnered, which was British forces being ordered to open live round fire on an ostensibly peaceful demonstration.
And it wasn't just like a one volley of shots. The whole thing went on for 20-25 minutes, and the army, it's come out through the two inquiries, the army had a plan that if there was a bit of stone throwing, they were going to teach the boys a lesson.
Well, I think
we shoot a few of them down, this will put them on the back foot, we'll show that we're in charge, smack a firm government, all the rest of it. And of course what they did is they set the whole thing going, because they'd forgotten about the history of these people.
Well, doesn't
was.
It occur to you that that may have been the intention?
Well,
anyway, the first
may
inquiry
be.
Was a whitewash, total whitewash. I mean, I've had a good look at this, and the most condemnatory statement made about the army firing into these unarmed civilians was that this behaviour was bordering on the reckless, which doesn't sound like a very sound like a very strong statement. Which is why I think, as part of the whole Northern Ireland peace process, there has been a reinvestigation of Bloody Sunday under something called the Savile Inquiry, which was due to be published in March 2010, but so far hasn't been published. It looks like it may be published at any time now. But anyway, what are your thoughts, Martin, on the whether the inquiries have actually got to the truth?
Well, to be honest with you, it's a lot of water under the bridge now, and the inquiries were not actually a bottom line demand of the Republicans. They said, look, Bloody Friday followed Bloody Sunday when the IRA bombed Protestant restaurants in the centre of Belfast, because they knew that the army had got together with Protestant businessmen to cook up what had happened the previous Sunday. So the IRA bombed the restaurants where they were all having a nice dinner and killed nine of these Protestant businessmen. So, it was tit for tat straight away. Straight away. And of course, then everybody got armed up and the whole thing really took off. And that was probably the worst period, the immediate post period of that. People were being killed on all sides. It was turning into a bloodbath.
One of the flip sides to the bombing campaign that then started after that was that, of course, the opposition fighters were being armed and paid by the British government.
Yeah.
And I would strongly suggest that if Northern Ireland at the time had been declared a war zone, then what happened on Bloody Sunday would be treated as an atrocity of war and heads would have rolled over it. But because it was a civil disturbance that just happened to precipitate in an armed response, nobody, I don't think, has ever been brought to justice over it, nor ever will, when in fact what occurred was cold-blooded murder.
Yeah. I mean, you've got to remember that on the Republican side, people who've carried out atrocities, the state, both states, have pursued them to the ends of the earth. They're never able to rest easy. Whereas, of course, the state's criminals are drawing pensions at our expense as we speak, probably,
and giving lecture tours.
Well, as the the army unit that did fire into the unarmed civilians was from the parachute regiment. I thought it would be quite interesting to finally to ask Richard Cowley, who we had on just now, the ex-soldier, about you know, what his thoughts were about the links between the parachute regiment and Bloody Sunday, and most importantly, do you think that that kind of thing could happen by accident, that soldiers could fire into unarmed civilians? What about the fact that you were actually a soldier in the parachute regiment? Because of the crucial importance on Bloody Sunday of the shots which were fired into a civilian crowd by the parachute regiment?
We didn't actually know anything about Bloody Sunday when we were there in 1980. Oddly enough, most parachute regiment soldiers, as I said, of our age group, are basically very semi-literate types of people. Maybe it was just me, because coming from Kenya, my background, even though I went to St. Mary's School, which essentially was a Catholic school, I actually knew nothing about politics or had ever heard of Bloody Sunday. And that's how basic people are in the parish. There might be a few people from Northern Ireland or maybe parts of London that are more politically promoted to join the parish, but I was a sports parachutist and I joined for other reasons, essentially. When I was based there in 1980, I think I replicate essentially most, as a stereotypical example of most kind of squaddies there. We're assuming that, I'd imagine that all these people from one para that were actually involved in the Bloody Sunday incident must have been the same kind of mentality and certainly rank. But I've read a lot about that, and I've seen films since then, and I'm not entirely sure that it wasn't a prearranged kind of stunt. You know, I'm fairly sure that there was something more associated with the intent to do that as a more organized initiative. I don't think that most people that I know that were at my rank would have what we call a negligent discharge. I don't think that it would be the case that we would easily find ourselves firing into a crowd of people that we were obviously unarmed, and unless we could see people firing at us with the yellow card practice that we had, even though it was only about a week's training, I can't believe that we would have returned fire into a crowd of people that, unless we could see arms firing at us back. You know, it would be very unlikely that that would occur. Having the experience and being there and having that live weapon in your hand and having the experience of actually doing this, the routine and the discipline of the parachute regiment is absolutely outrageous. You can't possibly fail to understand that a negligent discharge, for example, will cost you £300, and it doesn't happen very often because of that reason specifically, as well as being well trained. But I find it very difficult to believe that a bunch of paras would just let off as many rounds as they did and subsequently hit 14 people. You know, it all sounds very kind of like deliberate.
Don't you think this sort of thing is bound to happen, though, when you've got armies patrolling in civilian areas?
No. I don't think that that's a routine thing that I would imagine is an established characteristic of specific to paras, but even any other unit. I just don't think that would happen very often at all.
Do you think there would possibly have been orders for this, then, from senior officers and from politicians?
I have a suspicion, having, you know, read and studied this recently in conjunction, if I can mention the example of the Miami Showband, where odd things occur, such as the stealing of TA uniforms and the distribution of illegal weapons into the UDA area. I'm fairly sure that there's something like that, of an arranged conspiracy between people at a higher rank to do that kind of thing. Certainly, yeah, I would have thought so.
And what about political input? Because it's very difficult, I would have thought, for the military to get away with this without some kind of political approval.
Yeah, I'm really staggered and surprised that they have got away so far with it so lightly, because it seems so obvious that 14 people were murdered, and there's no doubt about that. Having studied the Bloody Sunday thing, you know, with the Stevens Inquiry, well, I'm looking forward to the results of that. And it's taken 10 years at least, and £200 million, too. I just can't understand it. It all seems rather UFO to me, you know, quite odd.
Martin, that was Bryn Richard Cowley, our ex-parachute regiment member, saying the whole thing seems very odd. He even used the word there, UFO, to describe what he thinks of the chances of having people, soldiers shooting live rounds into the civilians without there being really any consequences for those involved.
Well, there were huge consequences because, of course, the war really got going from that point on. And
but not for those who were supposed to be responsible on that day.
No. I mean, but it was a big, big own goal by the British Army that day. I mean, in many ways, that was the source of a lot of the problems that then came along. So we've actually got with us Kevin McGimpsey. Who's
Kevin McGimpsey, that's my
Irish. Yeah, that's your Irish name. And he's a native of Northern Ireland, originally from County Down, but lived in Belfast in the 80s and the 90s, I understand, Kevin.
Yeah.
And I suppose you would describe you as being from the nationalist side or from the you know, that you're a Catholic.
I was my politics are where then they were, in the 1980s, they were Republican with a capital R. Now they're Republican with a smaller.
Yeah, and you're currently an artist based in Bristol. What sort of discrimination or sectarianism did you experience living in Belfast in those years?
Well, I did experience when I went to university. This is like when it really hit home was that I was because my parents were living in Scotland at the time, I was put into a hall which was I didn't know it at the time, but basically what they'd done was that they had separated Catholics and Protestants into separate halls, or in there was multi-story buildings as well, and most of those buildings were divided up. So you had one floor was of a Protestant floor, and next floor was a Catholic floor, etc., etc. And this was how they operated. Of course, none of this was admitted, but I experienced persecution because of how they perceived me when I moved into the house, because I told them I was studying Celtic studies, and then they put two and two together, made five, and they started to persecute me, and I was physically attacked on one occasion. And
it's funny you should mention that, because one of the people I would like to mention on this show who's been forgotten is Sheena Campbell, who was actually a Republican activist, a younger Republican activist at Queen's University in the 1990s, and she was actually an up and coming political activist of great promise. She'd actually designed Sinn Féin's election strategy, and of course she was very much part of that whole move of the Republican movement into electoral politics, and she was actually a key figure in all of that. Mm. And she was drinking in York Bar, which is just off the campus, I understand, and the UDA came in and shot her dead, 26 years old, in front of her boyfriend, possibly somebody that could have ended up being President of Ireland, like Mary McAleese, but of course not, dead. And that's somebody that should be remembered, because she was actually one of those that pushed towards a more kind of political role for the Republican movement, and her reward was to die. Now, Kevin, I just want to ask Kevin another question, because you were actually at Mairead Farrell's funeral, weren't you?
I was, yes.
Which was attacked by the loyalists.
Yes.
I mean, we've got to be quick on this because we're running up to the news. How was that?
Well, I heard bangs and I looked up at the sky and there was hand grenades coming down. So,
so they killed three people. It was Michael Stone, didn't he? Killed three of the mourners at the funeral. And of course, the next day there was the two British Army guys were killed.
Two guys in the Signals Regiment. It all got very unpleasant. I didn't go to that funeral. I'd had enough by the end of that one. I didn't go to the second one.
No. I'm just looking at Tony. Have we got time for a poem? Yeah. We'll carry on talking. Yeah. Okay. Well, Yeah, I mean, the what happened the next day with the killing of the two soldiers, I think that was a tragedy, but it was also a very interesting tragedy. Because they were actually rescued from the mob that were beating them to death by the IRA, and then they were executed. But not, you know, but they stopped the mob beating them up. And my own view about those soldiers was that they were probably there to slot any loyalists who were going to turn up to do anything.
Okay, Martin, we've got the news coming up now, and we'll continue this after the news.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol. It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.